All right, this is Pure Decking for March the 15th, the year 3000. This is the show about stuff that interests me. I'm Morps. Tonight we've got RU46, Sardonyx, Syntax, and Auten. Hey, guys.
Yo. So,
hey.
And
crocodiles ate my face.
And Syntax and Auten are sharing a microphone, so this is going to be interesting.
What do you mean? It just shows the professional level of the station.
Speak for yourself, dude.
Professional?
Yeah, yeah.
I was going to say there are varying levels of awesome going on here, and that's where we're at.
All right, well, let's open up with the... I didn't get anything in the way of feedback, so other than taking the show to once a week, we've got nothing in station news. Sard, do you have anything station news-wise?
No. Not really.
Okay. Well, thought I'd just give you the shot there. So first thing I've got in current events is the Anonymous OS was put out, and somebody set up anonymous-os.tumblr.com. And this is a Ubuntu respin that uses the Mate fork of the GNOME desktop, so it looks like the old GNOME. And it's full of scripts and tools and a Tor installation that apparently doesn't work. And it's pretty interesting because, and of course, they've got it all themed up, right? So it's Ubuntu with a theme and some scripts thrown in it. And here's the really funny part, though. Shortly after this came out, the Anon Ops Twitter account posted, "The Anon OS is fake and it is wrapped in Trojans." Now,
surprise!
Yeah.
Surprise, anal sex!
No one saw that coming.
I love when people go and try and be all punny with their writing and say that it's wrapped in Trojans.
Well, that's the thing that I don't get, is it's a freaking Linux base. I mean, yes, there are Trojans for Linux, like four, but that's not to say that there's not security issues on a Linux install. Don't misunderstand. But the word Trojans there just doesn't, at least the way you normally think of a Trojan. Usually I would be more concerned about there being SSH keys already, you know, sitting in the keychain there. I'd be worried about scripts that are just leaving ports open, or maybe we've already got a flipping shell in it that just connects up to a server somewhere. Now, I got an article here from BGR.com, and of course, there's been hundreds of articles on this thing. The hacker group Anonymous Operations has confirmed that the custom Linux-based operating system released under its name earlier this week is not a platform it developed. The Anon OS is fake, the group posted on Twitter Wednesday evening. It's wrapped in Trojans. The desktop operating system was released earlier this week by individuals claiming to be ties to Anonymous. It is based on popular Linux distribution Ubuntu, ships with a number of hacking tools pre-installed. According to Anonymous, it also ships with a variety of malware. The team behind the Anonymous...
And comes from Nigeria.
Yeah, probably does. Well, it's on Tumblr. So, the team behind Anonymous OS responded to the group's claims, denying that its platform contains any malicious software. The Anonops on their Twitter account say, "The Anonymous OS is wrapped in Trojans," the group wrote on its Tumblr blog. "Please, people in our world, Linux and open source world, there's not a virus," which also makes you think that their English is not very good. "If any user believe that Anonymous OS is wrapped in Trojans or backdoored OS by any law enforcement company or hacker, please don't download it. But don't mislead the world that Linux is dangerous and has Trojans." So they've got that posted on the front of their Tumblr page. So I have not honestly had a chance to pull this down. I didn't even see it yesterday. Analog sent me an email about it coming out last night, and I didn't even get a chance to mess with it. And,
okay, so as long as someone comes out and goes, no, it's okay. We don't have to. Yeah, there's no viruses or anything like that. No, it's okay. Then
You see, they're arguing that there's all this malware in it, and there's not a lot of malware for Ubuntu, to be honest. it's there. I mean, there's a Java version of Interpreter, and you could put all kinds of malicious scripts in it, but it would all have to be kind of custom developed. It wouldn't be, you know, say a Zeus bot, for example.
Right, but is anyone not surprised? I actually did see this.
I am a little bit surprised just for one reason. Just for one reason alone.
Dude, it's Anon, or someone claiming to be Anon.
Let me finish. The reason is because I thought it might be the FBI putting it out so they can track who downloads it.
Well, hell yeah, that makes sense.
But it doesn't, because you know there's script kiddies out there that are going to download it because it says Anon.
That's true. That's very true.
You aren't going to get anyone legitimate is not
going to.
No,
anyone legitimate's already using Backtracker, their own, you know, built version of Linux.
Exactly.
Personally, I think even if Anon did put it out, I think they put it out just to see how many script kiddies are going to put it out, and it's for the lulz. It's not for anything else, but for someone to sit there and point and laugh.
That's very true. But, I mean, I don't know. I've seen so much better attempts at putting out, you know, some group's Linux distro than this thing. I mean, I don't know. It seems plausible that it's probably full of a bot. You know, it's probably got scripts in it. It's probably got SSH backdoors. But, you know, nobody checks this shit. Hell, the Amazon AW2? Am I saying that right? I'm blanking on their cloud service. But nobody was checking the images for them, and there were all kinds of backdoors and SSH keys in the Linux installs people were standing up their websites on. So,
nice.
You know,
that's full of wind.
Yeah, so I wouldn't be surprised at all if their distro has all kinds of tracking crap in it. So, but I mean, other better tools exist. I mean, if you could always just go download Ubuntu and theme it and then drop in whatever scripts you need or, you know, just grab a Backtrack distro. But I would almost argue if you're pulling down this tool to use to do attacks on websites and you're doing it because you don't know what scripts you want.
You're doing it wrong.
Yeah. If you don't know what scripts you want and you're pulling down this tool because somebody can, you know, says, oh, use this, this, and this, and this, then you're not going to help much because you don't know what you're doing. You're going to break something or get yourself caught.
Exactly. So, it's the same thing with the Orbital Ion Cannon where fuck it is.
Oh, yeah.
Here, download this Windows program, run it on your box, and say you're part of Anonymous. Ho, ho, ho. I don't know. It's just ridiculous.
I love the low Orbital Ion Cannon because it's so simple. It's a voluntary botnet. And I love the concept. It's like, no, we need a botnet to attack these people. Never mind the fact that you're exposing your IP address, you're exposing whatever computer to whatever malware they put in. Hell, we did a story a couple of weeks ago where Symantec had reported that somebody had hijacked an anonymous release of Slowlaris and filled it with a Zeus Trojan.
Why are we telling them how to do it right?
Because that's kind of what we do.
No, let the idiots download this Ion Cannon. It's fucking hilarious, man.
Yeah, they get their ass caught. So
exactly. I know, you're getting all white hat on this shit? No, fuck that. Tell them to download it. I like to point and laugh at idiots. It's fun. It saves me having to go out into the street and trip people over myself.
Well, I kind of think of it like this. If you're dumb enough to pull down this tool, this distro, and just run the scripts in it following, you know, some pastebin post, you're probably not listening to our show. You're probably, you know, on 4chan doing what some B-thread tells you to do, which we all know how well that ends.
I thought everyone just did whatever a B-thread told you to do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, dude. Make crystals, man. Make those homemade crystals. They're the win.
And turn your toaster sideways to make a sandwich there. That ends well. So, yeah. All right. Rocket Snail, next. Let's see here. This one's from the Atlantic Wire. It kind of falls in the no-duh category, but it's pretty fun. A group of hackers calling themselves the Consortium are claiming to be affiliated with Anonymous and Lulzsec broke into the the writing on this is terrible. Broke into digitalprogram.com.
Okay, wait, it's the with the...
Yeah. I'm trying to figure it out. It's whatever. The third porn site attacked you in as many weeks, stealing 72,000 passwords and 40,000 credit card numbers. All three porn sites the consortium has targeted are owned by Luxembourg-based Manwin Braziers. Got hit in mid-February 350,000 usernames and passwords were stolen. And then it came a major hack at YouPorn. 1 million usernames and passwords were compromised. But the porn network does not seem to be the real target of the attack. The hackers seem to be most interested in embarrassing government employees who use their official email addresses to register for a porn site. Why would
fucking
you do this?
Idiots. Wow.
They were using their iPads to get to the porn sites. And this is how they got them.
Hang on. Toasty! There you go.
I was just about to call bullshit on this story because I was going to say there's no way there's 40,000 people, 40,000 credit card numbers in that database. Okay. There's porn on the internet for free.
Well,
but
I've got...
obviously, now we see the caliber of people we're dealing with.
Yeah.
So,
isn't porn all free?
There's enough free porn out there. I don't know why you'd ever need to pay for it.
But exactly.
Going on with the article here, as avian.com reports, according to the consortium, it's hacked 27 admin names, usernames, and email passwords and encrypted passwords, 85 affiliate usernames, plain text passwords, and in some cases IP addresses, and 82.gov and .mil email addresses with corresponding plain text passwords. Now, here's the really fun part.
Why the fuck were they sending passwords plain text?
Because whatever site was...
MacOS! Because they were using iPads and tablets to fuck around on public networks. Right.
Wow.
This is how they sent it.
So tell me, when did the Apple fanboys beat you up? Was it when you were a small child, or, I mean...
No. My problem with the Apple boys was that they never actually talked to anyone that, like us, that said, hey, wait a minute, so I want to have this device that's awesome, but I don't know how to secure it. And once more, I want everyone and their dog to own it, and I want them to download third-party apps and pay me to hack their device. And is this okay? And Apple said, hell yeah. Here, let me give you the platform, and let's roll with this. And now, since it's Apple and it's cool and you're using our devices, you have to put them on your network. I was never beat up. I'm sorry. I honestly see this as that type of device.
But this, okay, okay.
Show us on the doll where the netbook touched you.
Okay, but in all fairness, if they're pulling plain text from a... they're hacking a porn site, right? So if they're pulling a plain text passwords, that means the porn site was storing them in their database in plain text. This is not actually a fault of the user being on an Apple or on a PC or on Linux.
No, it's the fact that they had lax security on the site.
Yeah, this is whoever was running the site was a moron and didn't know that it's called hashing. But, most programming languages actually have MD5 and SHA-1 built into them now. Thanks for calling. But
for a long time now.
Yeah, that's not the point I wanted to make here. They've got 82.gov.mil email addresses with corresponding plain text passwords. You want to take a wild fucking guess how many of those accounts are the exact same username and password on the porn site as they are on, say, the government portal sites?
Oh, yeah.
You know, hello, WikiLeaks.
So say we all.
So... anyways, though, it's great fun, and I don't know why anyone would register for a porn site using their government-provided...
Is that as a caliber of politician we have today, man? That fucking retarded.
Well, I mean,
who
it's
pays?
Like it's...
God damn.
Like it's that fucking hard to go get a free email account with Yahoo, Hotmail, or Google. I mean...
10-minute email.
You know, bug me not, for God's sake.
Yeah, Hushmail. There's a million.
Yeah, I mean, you know, go get an email account that's not your work email account that's going to be embarrassing when the site gets hacked.
These are the people that watch over us and create the laws.
The biggest question is, why would you pay for porn?
Yeah, because they're still hung up on that. I don't know. Maybe, you know, they just never figured it out.
Maybe they think it's safer that way. Maybe they think there's, like, some way they won't get caught if they pay for it. I'm just trying to rationalize this shit, man.
You know what it is, dude?
Works on the street, too, doesn't it? If you pay for it, you won't get caught.
Definitely. No, maybe dude, that's what they think. It's like prostitution. If I pay it, she'll shut up.
It's old people. That's all I got to say.
It's old people, yeah.
It's got to be. It's the only thing that makes sense to me.
I don't hate on the old people, man.
What?
It's
you hate on everyone.
Old people suck. And all the politicians are old. Don't know how to use a computer.
I think what he's saying is that old people tend to get one email address and use it for everything, and that's what
everything.
Yeah. And I could believe that.
Most liable to pay for porn, too.
Well, I don't know, man. You hear some of those retirement villages are some of the worst places to go if you don't, you know, when it comes to STDs. So.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I so ran a story on that.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Next one up here. This is awesome. Microsoft just released MS-12-020. This is a remote code execution in RDP, Remote Desktop Protocol. Every Windows server on the planet has RDP turned on. Oops. So Microsoft has released a patch. This is good. How many people patch their servers in a timely fashion?
None. The second I saw this story.
I did.
Yeah, fuck yes, I did.
Oh, I did too. Don't get
me wrong. Well, hell yeah, I did. The minute I read this, I went, really?
Yeah. Yep. Any sysadmin worth their weight freaking pass this shit around the second I saw it.
Now, here's the real question. How many people are going back and patching their Windows 2003, their Windows XP boxes that are running some little piece of software that they're using as a server? Yeah. Oh. This is going to be like MS-086.
Server.
Yeah. Yeah. In the real world, people use whatever computer they got handy. So this is going to be like MS-086.67. It's just not going to go away, and it's going to be a free way into any It's a free game over button is what this is going to be for a very, very long time.
Well, I would hope that any, you know, company that has 3389 added to one server. Well, I don't know.
No, I'm hoping
that, you know, that they don't have very many freaking RDP ports open to the internet. You know,
yeah, you know,
you would think you would keep track of that.
They leave it open
and know
they will learn. Eventually.
That's true, too.
Yeah, after they're, you know, it's like they come to the IT department, somebody hacked my computer. Well, we told you that not to turn that on. Well, I needed that. Why? To get on it from my iPad. Yeah, yeah.
So I could download my paid-for porn.
Well, anyways, I got a blurb here from the TechNet blog. Security update MS-12-020 addresses two vulnerabilities in Microsoft implementation of RDP. One of the two, CVE- 2012-0002 is a critical remote code execution vulnerability affecting all versions of Windows. So this goes back to like 2K. This blog post shares additional information with the following goals. Strongly encourage you to make a special priority applying this particular update. Yeah, yeah. So, and there's basically they're complaining that it was privately reported and they're not aware of any attacks in the wild, but they're expecting them very, very soon. So,
well, of course, because now they've released a patch. Someone's just going to reverse engineer the patch and see, oh, this is what this is fixing.
Spider Lab says this awesome blog post, and I've got some snippets of it here. So if you missed our previous blog post on the MS Patch Tuesday early this week, or you missed any of the several dozen news articles, there's a pretty serious hole patched up in the latest update from Redmond. Microsoft calls it critical and numbered MS-12-020. It's a hole in RDP that you blah, 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 skip ahead a bit. Here we go. The first thing we notice on analysis of the patch, if you compare the patch to the original, you can find out that was changed. And what they're saying is people have already done this. There's actually a Freenode channel, MS-12-020, of people trying to actively get the exploit for it. And here's the really fun part. The race for a working exploit of MS-12-020 is so dramatic there's even a bounty for the first working Metasploit module for this hole. It was up to $1,451.
Awesome. Wow. I love the internet.
That's the winning comment right there, Sard. I love the internet. So what this is, the moment there's a working exploit for this, you're going to see some worms pick it up. There are lots of networks that don't block remote desktop because they've got a VP who wants it open, or they've got some sysadmins who insist that they need it to administer the web servers.
But that's okay, dude. It's okay to have RDP open. The problem is they aren't patching their systems.
Who the hell does that?
Well, that's the problem in my eyes. It's okay to have RDP.
Once a month, you should be that guy. Maybe twice a month. And you should have a beta in your test lab that you do this and the actual environment you should do it.
Well, that gets rough. One, you got to pay for the test lab, so most companies say fuck that noise. And then two,
not if you're in education.
Yeah.
They give you the test lab.
Yeah, the test lab for us is called, we've got some buildings that are considered the test labs. That way we get
that
real working environments.
I've done that also. There is nothing wrong with having a VLAN that you just section off for testing because they don't bitch as much.
Yeah, that's pretty much what we do. But
we actually convinced users to opt in to be guinea pigs. That's how awesome we are in negotiating.
Yeah. No, there should be no negotiation. You should look at them and go, this is what we're doing. You're going to like it.
You know,
so are you telling me that your negotiation skills come down to getting someone to click apply? That's it.
Dude, sometimes that's all
screw
it is.
Screw that. Force it down by group policy and choke it down.
See, you're making assumptions here that you... Well... Where I work,
we're talking about the end user. Here.
Yes, yes.
Come on, who has all the awareness of the dead?
No,
to be honest.
No, that's totally
fair
point.
That's a fact, actually. He's exactly right. They can barely spell PC or computer, and
yeah
that's correct. But but what I'm saying is that's why we take that kind of sidestep and say, okay, you don't know what the hell you're doing, so let me do this for you.
Yeah,
exactly. Right. That's why I'm saying there should be NAT rules that, okay, if this one person really needs RDP on their computer, all right, we NAT this external IP to their computer. We make sure that computer is patched. It's not like open 3389 for freaking everyone.
I'm listening to this, and yeah, it's this is all great, but it doesn't help when I'm going to drop a fucking bomb right here that yes, the government servers here in Australia, if you want in with my password and my whole... You want into the government servers right now. If you know my real name, you type it in as password and fucking user. That is the in. They won't let me change it.
Yeah. That's See, and this smart. Is the point I've been trying to make, is that, sure, if you've got a network where you've got a couple of competent sysadmins who are keeping things patched, who are watching the... You know, watching the store, checking their logs, keeping a firewall configured for God's sake, then, you know, yes, this isn't that big of a deal. You still have somebody who brings in a laptop that's Trojaned that'll start spreading through RDP. That shit happens.
And all it,
but look,
all it takes is one fuck up at any point in the chain.
Yeah, no, you've got to be perfect. To make security work, it has to be absolutely fucking perfect, which is why we're all doomed to failure. But the point I'm trying to make is that for every network where you've got, you know, the competent group who are going up to the users, smacking them upside the head and said, no, we're doing it right, you've got 14 networks out there, be they small business, educational, medium company, whatever.
Government,
definitely. That they're just, you know, they hire some fucker who, you know, masturbates half the day looking at porn sites, probably while paying for it. And then the other half of the time, they're just walking around going, have you tried turning it off and on again? And they don't know shit. And it's like, well, regulation said it had to be going through a firewall. So we took our power drill, cut a hole through the firewall, ran an Ethernet cord through it. There, it's going through
there
the firewall. So, because they don't know how to configure a firewall. They don't know how to configure VPN. They don't know how to do anything. They shouldn't even be doing the job. But these networks are out there. Anyone who's done penetration testing knows exactly what the fuck I'm talking about. I still get into systems to this day on MS-0867. That was patched 4 years ago. My point is that this is not going to be going away anytime soon.
I have no apathy for those systems. I don't know. I guess there, you know,
because those systems are going to be botted. They're going to be used in attacks against my network, even though I am doing my job, and I'm going to have those systems coming into my network because some dumbass is going to, you know, connect to that network with a laptop. Some vendor or traveling salesman or something's going to get on some pwned network with a laptop, get that thing owned, then come onto my network, and it's going to start spreading internally. You actually have to do host-to-host security to lock this crap out. I would also recommend changing the port you use RDP on.
Yeah, I don't know why anyone would ever use a standard port for anything.
Because it comes back to the same reason they want to make it illegal to not tell the police your password. It's too hard.
Hang on. I'm an end user. What's a port?
It's a number at the end of your IP.
There you go.
That
no, that's
what
I mean.
It is.
That's what we're dealing with. What's yeah. a port?
At that point, you just go, "Oh no, no, it's a pretty little number. Don't worry about it."
See, Morps. This goes back to my earlier comment a couple shows ago. Where's that computer user's license? If you had to take a test, then you would be forced to know this shit.
I so dig you guys. You are so the guys I wish were with me every day other than my boss. Because what the hell you're saying right there about a computer license makes 110% sense. You don't give some guy a rifle or a shotgun. Well, yeah, so we do sometimes. But the fact is, there's a lot of damage you could do with a computer. We don't just throw them behind the wheel and say, go.
Well, last week we talked about the Windows 8 consumer release and how it looked like they were trying to move desktop computing away from general purpose to be more application-based, sort of like the tablets and the smartphones.
What I see there, though, is unified user experience between your phone, between whatever.
Yeah, but the user experience from a phone moved onto the desktop sucks ass.
Agreed. Don't get me wrong. But if you're talking about the users that don't have the license, what the hell do they care as long as they can do their stuff?
That's the point we were making about that last show. And Sard, you know, I suggested that what's going to happen is you're going to still have your general purpose computers, but you have to have a license to use them but if you're just doing a tablet or a web TV or whatever, you know, you don't need a license for that. And then Sard loved the idea, and I'm like, no, that's scary as hell.
I think what's going to end up happening is the digital you. Whether it doesn't matter what device you're using, the user experience is going to be the same. You're going to be the single person, regardless of what device you're on. It's going to know what permissions, what you need, and it's going to hand it to you. And that's where I think Windows 8 is going. It's stupid. It's hokey. It's for pokes. But that is, in fact, what I think they're trying to do, is bring up the civilian world to what we do.
Well, I don't mind that so much. I really don't mind them putting an easier interface in front of this stuff. If that means, you know, I have to spend less time at my grandmother's house helping her configure a printer, then great. But, you know,
that would always be a plus.
Yeah. But, you know, it was like I was saying, I don't think it's a conspiracy. I think it's going to become an excuse. You have got the technology companies trying to bring it down to a level that's easiest for everyone. And then you're going to have government step in and go, well, gee, look, we got all this anonymous stuff. We got everything else going on. Yeah, if you want to use something that's not one of these, you know, Fisher-Price interfaces that can only do a web browser and, you know, pre-approved applications, then they'll want to put a license on it. Now, you know, we can go back and forth as to whether or not you think that's a good thing. I personally think it's terrifying, but, you know.
Yeah, that's fucking frightening.
Because, well, I mean, how the hell would I run something like Galaxy 15 if it has to be licensed? Because you've heard some of the shit we've said on the station. They'd shut us down. We'd be subject to FCC regulations.
But that's what I'm saying, man, is I see exactly where you're going with it, but I see the world becoming stupider, and that's what the hell we're having to deal with. The sysadmins is people that deal with this type of thing on a daily basis. We're having to dumb down the services we give them and give it to them in a PEZ, basically.
Luckily, I don't have that problem. I break into the system, find the problems, then hand that to a sysadmin and walk away and go to the next one. So, okay. We're gonna beat that one all day long here. So, I got the final story here. This is just comical. I laughed at this so hard my boss thought something was wrong when I read this at work earlier today. SendThemYourMoney.com. The problem, the MPAA and the RIAA claim that the internet is stealing billions of dollars of their property by sharing copies of files. They're willing to destroy the internet with things like SOPA and PIPA in order to collect that money. The solution, let's just send them the money. They've made it very clear that they consider digital copies to be just as valuable as the originals. That makes it a lot easier to pay them back in two ways. A, we can email them scanned images of dollar bills instead of bulky paper. And B, we don't have to worry about the hassle of shipping huge quantities of cash. And how to help on this website. This is a total joke, but I love it. How to help. Take a picture or scan an image of your money. Send digital copies to the MPAA and the RIAA and other whatever quantity you feel you can afford. Don't go over.
Isn't that still against federal law?
Oh, yeah. But they've got their Wikipedia has a picture of the dollar bill. That's what they got it for this website. But don't go overboard. If you can only afford 20 copies, then that's good enough. If enough people contribute, we should be able to fully satisfy even the most outrageous demands.
I'm down. I'm gonna go to my place of business. I'm gonna empty a cash register. I'm gonna take a picture of it. Then I'm gonna put it all back. Then I'm gonna send them the pictures.
But, you know, you want to do it one by one to use up as much bandwidth and fill up as many email boxes as possible.
What? Yeah.
But I mean, I just love the concept here because they're making an argument here that a digital copy is worth as much as the original. Therefore, a digital copy of money should be worth just as much as the original to them.
That is awesome.
I love the logic. It was hilarious when I read it earlier today. It's a joke site, but they've got some contact information for the MPAA and the RIAA on there. They also have a picture of a dollar bill you can use if you can't be bothered to scan one of your own, and they have one in ASCII art.
Nice.
So if you want to mail bomb them and be like, yeah, I'm going to pay for the Pirate Bay. Here's, you know, 15,000 JPEGs. So, yeah.
Dude, my B folder alone, I'm rich.
I wonder if we can pay for porn that way.
Oh, I just got a message from Knox. He said, send them pictures of pennies.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, that's hilarious.
No, Zimbabwe dollars, man. They were nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. The only sad part is they wouldn't get the joke. Oh, well. Let's move on here to a project for Digital Dojo.
Me love you long time.
So, the project I picked out here for Digital Dojo is honestly not a terribly difficult project, at least in the steps I'm going to outline here. I've said before, and I think I've said on several of the episodes of Pure Decking, I live in a Backtrack install. I use it daily. And frankly, it's just easier to grab Backtrack than it is to set up a box I need with all the tools on it. So, you know, hell, if this has already got 70% of what I need, and it's easy enough for me to add that to it rather than starting from scratch with an Arch Linux or Ubuntu install. So,
makes sense.
Yeah. Although I should point out, if you're using Backtrack and you don't know how to set up Metasploit, and you don't know how to set up Aircrack, and you don't know how to set up Set or Burp Suite or Peros Proxy. I'm trying to think of all the tools I use on a daily basis. They're freaking Nmap. Then, even though you can grab Backtrack and use it, you should still set up a virtual machine with, you know, a raw Fedora install or something, whatever distro you like, and sit there and figure out how to install and configure these things so you know what's going on under the hood. The thing with Backtrack is it makes it very easy to hop in and get going, and it's very nice because you can get it all updated very, very quickly. But if you don't know what's in the Metasploit folder, you're wasting your time. You're actually hurting yourself because, you know, sure, you can run Armitage and, you know, hit things with MS-0867 or this new 12.020 exploit when that comes out. But if you don't know what's actually going on under the hood, you're a script kiddie, and you're not doing anyone any good.
Yeah.
So, now that I've pointed that out, I enjoy keeping a Backtrack Live thumb drive handy. And first of all, I'm going to point out, using Backtrack is, if you don't know what you're doing with a Linux install, Backtrack can be really difficult to get anything done with, because most of the tools have no GUI. It's all command line, for the most part. But,
and the best way to get familiar, at least in my opinion, like, probably, oh, 5-6 years ago or so, I didn't know shit about Linux, but I was intrigued by it, and I started using it, you know, trying to use it more and more for my job, and really the only way that I felt that I really got to know the ins and out of it is you go load up a workstation and you use it every single fucking day. Mm-hmm. And it's going to frustrate the fuck out of you for a while, but after a while, you start figuring stuff out, and it becomes not so foreign after that.
And yeah, you know, too, that, there's always Google.
And the other way, one of the ways that I did it is I put it on a machine that I didn't really care about, but I wanted to learn to use it. So I put it on there. I used it. I broke shit. In fact, I broke a lot of shit. I broke that machine several times and had to reload. But don't be afraid to break it.
What I did when I wanted to really, really understand Linux, I took my main workstation and I backed up everything I cared about. I wiped the hard disk and I installed Gentoo from stage one. I had an old beater laptop I was using to get my email and a few other things that I was able to use. But I couldn't play any games. I couldn't do anything with it hardly except get a web browser open. And for about 2 weeks, I did not have my main workstation online because I was determined to get Gentoo installed. And I did. You get an outstanding understanding of what's going on in a Linux system. I don't really recommend using Gentoo on a daily basis as a workstation desktop. It's pretty frustrating. But for learning it, if you want to learn Linux, do a Gentoo install from stage one. And they used to have an awesome manual. I haven't checked lately, but I'm sure their documentation is still top notch. You follow that manual, and you'll know what's going on in a Linux install. So it's a very good way to really force yourself to learn it. Now,
and the other plus on it is when some coworker comes up and goes, "Hey, let me use your box so I can check my email." You can go, "All right, if you can do it, rock out."
They sit down and look at it and go, where's the start button? You don't get a start button. I'm going to go use Bill's computer now.
Exactly.
So, anyways, though, the way I usually go about making a Backtrack live thumb drive is I start with an 8 or a 16 gig thumb drive, usually a 16 gig. And there's a Windows tool I like to use when I'm setting these up called Live Linux USB. Now, actually, I think they've put out other versions, but I usually just run it on my work laptop, which has their Windows image on it. So, and what that does is you feed it the Backtrack ISO, it extracts it, puts it on the flash drive, creates your bootloader, modifies it for persistent storage, and then creates a 4-gig file called Casper-RW. Now, if you've only got an 8-gig thumb drive, you're probably done. You don't need to bother with the partitioning. If you have a bigger flash drive and you want to have some decent storage space, what I always do is I delete that Casper-RW file, and then I boot into another Linux install. Usually it's the one on my laptop, but it could be anything. Generally, the thing you want to get at is the tool called Parted, because you want to resize the FAT32 partition that's on your flash drive down. I usually shrink mine down to about 4 gig. And then I make a new EXT2 partition. And I think I've actually got a link in the show notes. Yeah, to Pendrive Linux that explains how to do some of this. Since the Live USB creators already modified the bootloader for you, all you have to do is create an EXT2 partition on the flash drive and name it Casper-RW. And it will pick it up, and it will use it. And this is really cool, because what you end up with is a 4-gig flash drive that Windows will see, and then the rest of the space is devoted to your Linux install and actually storing the changes made to the file system in real time, which means when you boot up Backtrack off this flash drive, any changes you make to the system persist. So when you update things, the updates go into that EXT2 partition, and it saves them for next time. If you write a custom script, it saves it. If you make a shortcut inside the home folder to the FAT32 partition on the flash drive or a folder on it so that you can save stuff out so you can get at it on a Windows partition. I don't know about you guys, but what I consider real work usually happens for me in a Backtrack install. What my boss considers real work usually happens in a Windows install. That would be writing the reports and managing the email.
Being a sysadmin, I'm pretty much forced to use Windows because we have a Windows domain, and a lot of those tools don't run on Linux.
Exactly.
So I have to run a Windows VM.
See, now I've got a lot of freedom in how I get in and out of these systems, but I used to be really, really heavily anti-Windows, but I kind of got over it. Pretty much anymore, pick the tool that gets the job done best for you. If that means you've got to use Windows for some stuff for work, maybe they've got a custom email system, or in my case, they've got a bunch of custom reporting stuff that just for some ass reason will not work right in a Wine install. And, So I use my work issue Windows laptop for a lot of the reporting and stuff like that. So my reports generally go into a folder that I make on the FAT32 side of that flash drive, and I just make a symlink inside the home folder of the live backtrack that goes to that folder on the FAT32. So whenever I save out a report or a dump from a tool or just some notes, they go in that folder. So when I go onto the Windows side, I get access to all my files. And then Now the other thing is, once you've booted it up, since it saves your changes, you can go into apt-get update, apt-get upgrade. Then you can usually install a few other tools. I like to install Wi-Fi, Gparted, HTOP, just a few other handy little things that are in there. And the other cool thing is, since Backtrack is based on Ubuntu, you can actually add the PPAs to it. I've successfully broken several Backtrack installs doing that, so be careful. You know, goofing around with different desktop environments and stuff like that on it. But, yeah, you can actually do that.
There's nothing wrong with breaking an install.
Oh, no, absolutely not. Just, you know how to fix it or know how to roll back or, you know, if it comes to it, know how to start over again. But it's usually better if you can just fix it. With the flash drive, sometimes you'll break it to the point where you just can't get back in to the live distro and you almost have to start from scratch. But that's not as common as it used to be. The only reason that happens is, well, what I've managed to do several times is by ending around it, I was doing some low-level drive access with some Python scripting and wasn't really paying good attention to what I was doing and managed to screw up the compressed image files that the live distros boot from. Yeah, that's kind of hard to mount. You got to mount that up in a loopback file to try to fix that, which is kind of a pain in the ass. So generally it's easier just to start over. It's like, well, that version was getting out of date anyways. I'll just go pull down the latest and start over. So
learning point, that's all.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what it is. And that's usually why I keep several flash drives around is, you know, you've got one you don't care to screw up and you've always got a backup in case, you know, something goes out. Now, generally, you know, I'm kind of going over the process here. It's nothing really new making a live Linux flash drive. Making it a Backtrack and giving it a, you know, a nice persistence is handy. But, you know, none of this stuff is rocket science. There's nothing here being invented. You can script kiddie most of this stuff out if you know where to look for it on the site. Get on Google. You can figure out how to do this stuff in 15 minutes flat. I mean, it's not hard. There's tools out there to do it for you. Now, I'd listed out some uses here in the notes. Like, you know, obviously pen testing, start in the pen test folder. If you don't know what a tool does, Google it. There's always the man page.
If you don't know what a tool does,
don't run
it. See what it does.
Don't run it against a production system. Set up a VM or a target or something. But
shh, don't tell people that. Just let them fucking run it.
That will end well. It's sort of like when you mention Cain and Abel to somebody who really shouldn't, you know, hear that word. They go Google it, and the next thing you know, they're taking out networks. It's like, oh, yeah, I guess your laptop couldn't handle that whole fucking segment trying to be routed through it, huh? It's like, what? I thought it was just going to give me a Windows password. Yeah, it's because you don't know what the tool's fucking doing, do you? For those who aren't aware, Cain and Abel is a Windows tool, and Cain will do ARP spoofing and route all network traffic through your laptop. And depending on the size of the network, that will be a problem. Because your laptop probably can't keep up with that.
Just a bit.
But, you know, if you need a quick way to grab a Windows password, that actually, you know, it'll sniff SMB and credentials right off the line there. So that's your classic man-in-the-middle attack, by the way. The other nice thing is you can use it for system recovery and investigations. You can actually run Oftcrack right from that flash drive in the Backtrack install. Like, if you sit down on a machine that you need to get into, you can run Oftcrack right then and there from the flash drive. And because it's a persistent image, you can actually load down the flash drive with the bigger rainbow tables, assuming you've got a big enough flash drive, and have them on there ready to go, which is nice. It's a little bit easier than trying to use some of the live CDs that Oftcrack provides if you need to get into a box. Of course, they were really smart with it. It won't touch the hard drive till you tell it to, especially in forensics mode. And that's usually why that's one of the reasons I like to install Gparted is I can actually use that backtrack drive for partitioning up disks and doing system rescue, which is handy. And system testing, actually, it's nice if you're building a box to be able to boot something up without having to do a full OS install. And of course, flash drives are small and you can have fun modding them. I've painted mine. I've had several that ended up in alternative casing. I've got one that's wrapped in paracord, which I think it's just a storage drive right now, but it's really funny because that was the one we were using to pass around a couple of game installs. So several people call it the paracord drive now.
Nice.
But
you put it inside a piece of candy and you set it on someone else's desk and go, ooh, look, here, no, there's nothing on that. Just plug it in.
Yeah, that's if you load an auto run script. Anyways. So, and the other cool thing is
we've had this conversation.
Yeah, yeah. The other cool thing is this doesn't have to be a USB flash stick. It'll work with anything. The same process will work on a hard drive. It'll, you know, like if you got a little external hard disk, it'll work on an SD card. You probably have to put the SD card in one of those little USB readers to get it to go. I've done this on a compact flash card before and it worked fine. So
cool.
I've heard a rumor that somebody used an old iPod as a live, just as a hard disk to hold a Linux install, and it worked fine.
Talk about alternative casings. You could just gut it.
Oh, yeah. Nobody even questioned that.
If you had a broken one. Exactly.
Especially if you throw a couple of music files on there so you can, you know, quote unquote, show it off and test it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Anyways.
That means you would have to actually buy an iPod.
Well, if you had an old one laying around.
Or I was thinking, like, you know, people sell their broken ones for parts order on eBay. Pick them up for like 20 bucks.
Actually, at that point, when you pick them up, you want to see what's on them. So
yeah, that too. Good point.
Yeah, if you're buying hard disks off eBay, I recommend looking at them before you format them and put whatever on them. You'd be amazed at how many people's taxes information is still on these things. Not that I've done that. so, anyways, I know it was kind of a weaker pure decking segment, but it's a place to start. And something I kind of wanted to hit because it is something I use a lot. I don't know about you guys, live flash drives, but
I actually just used a live CD the other day to do some data recovery. I was getting a new box, and my old box, I don't know how the fuck I did it, but moving around, I don't know. I think I damaged the drive, but it wouldn't boot essentially.
Yeah. So, well, if the disk was spinning when you kicked it, that's a good way to do it.
Is that bad?
Don't kick. Well,
that might have been the issue then. But anyways,
I had a Linux file server I was using for a long time, and I didn't pay too much attention to it until I realized that it had the disk spinning constantly. And when I went to go check the disks, they were both about dead because it had just ran them into the ground. So check that stuff. I mean, even just leaving them spinning all the time is not good. So,
yep.
Anyways, that's pretty much all I had. Anybody else have anything they want to hit before we close out the show here?
No, I'm pretty good, man. 150th episode of I Have Nothing this weekend.
Yeah.
Should be good.
Yeah, that'll be fun. Woohoo! So.
Yeah, that's about it.
Syntax, we bore your friend there on the digital dojo since it wasn't real in-depth.
No. Here, hold on. Oh, not at all. But you remember I run a communist network, so therefore I don't use this type of environment very much. I just take it over, control it, own it, and do what the hell I want to.
Well, what if you need to do forensics on it? Like actually, you know, take a full-on...
If I need to do forensics and stuff, at that point, law enforcement's usually involved and are sealed. So
Fair point.
So usually at that point, I can see. And I can see the use of every bit you're showing here, man. Don't think I'm shorting you a bit.
No, I just...
My personal environment, when it comes to this, at about midway through it, I'm going, I could use it. No one else in my environment, except for my boss, maybe could use it. And we would probably use it for forensics if we had to be Sneaky Pete. Other than that, by the time we'd get to it, it's in a sealed environment, and the cops are already got the guy.
Fair enough. Yeah, now speaking of the other people have to use it thing, I had to set up some laptops at work for quote-unquote international travel into hostile territory. Of course, course, by hostile territory, I found out later they meant Britain, which I was just like, really? But okay, whatever. But yeah, they're really concerned about the Chinese, and you know, we had some people that were going to Britain, so they wanted us to set these things up, and it was like, wait, I didn't understand the reasoning, but whatever. So I set these things up, and I go to give it to them, and I start explaining how to use it. It's like, yeah, you know, other people have to be able to use these, because I had plausible deniability. These things had three different passwords on them you can enter to get into different environments. The whole thing was true crypted all to hell. It had a decoy operating system on it. And nice. They're like, yeah, other people have to be able to use this. Try again. So it's like,
that sucks.
I guess the only thing I have to say is listen to Between the Sheets. We have a guest this week.
Nice.
Nice.
That should be exciting.
Yeah. My pet Luna should be on as well. Oh. I'm sorry. Our pet Luna should be on.
Uh-oh. Already fighting for ownership of the pet. That
oh, yeah.
So, all right. Well, you know, time to wrap things up here. Listen to the stream. We're constantly updating it. Sard's always been looking for new music to add to it. I Have Nothing every Saturday. As we said, it's episode 150. I don't think we're actually doing anything special about it, but it's episode 150. Pure Decking every Thursday, Between the Sheets, tomorrow night. Apparently, they're having the pet on, so that would be good. NR7, whenever somebody manages to hit BSV with the cattle prod. The Galaxy 15 radio site and the Twitter handle if you want to catch the updates as soon as they're hit. That's pretty much all I've got. Has anybody else got anything else they wish to pimp?
Crickets.
Crickets.
Nothing but crickets.
I'm a real highly excited today.
In